Star Trek 57, M23, take two.
It's got Star Trek, Episode 1. The TOS pilots. The cage, and where no man has gone before.
Here among a billion stars, a lonely ship streaks along an endless path. It's the mammoth starship Enterprise. Follow her trackless journey each week on Star Trek. William Shatner stars as Captain James Kirk, Starship Commander, and Leonard Nimoy stars as Science Officer Spock, half Earthling, half Vulcanian. There are hazards that beset the Enterprise and its crew on board ship and on alien planets. Don't miss Star Trek In Color.
Talking about?
I don't know.
Jesse.
I'm just waiting to do the Star Trek podcast.
Oh, okay, then we should start.
Let's go.
Just start. We should start.
Star Trek. Nothing but Star Trek.
If you start talking about it, then it'll
Mr. Spock.
It'll happen.
Burbank, Burbank, Burbank. What's the I Love Lucy theme song? How does that one go? Yeah, that's right.
Something like that. So they did this. They did the Star Trek in Desilu Studios, and after they did that, the Cage pilot, Lucille Ball was one of the people that was like, you know, they should try this again. Let's like, she was one of the people that was sort of pro Star Trek. Like, let's give these guys a chance. Let's give them some more money. Like,
yeah, I think she was a big supporter of them.
That's
why I brought it up, because I noticed that at the end of.
And then, yeah, it always says Desilu at the end.
Yeah, and I never noticed that. I never thought to look for it. I was wondering if that's why there's all the bongos in the theme song. Like, do you think Desi had something to do with, like, the playing?
What, you mean in the Star Trek
I think it was a completely different...
Because it's, like, it's so, like...
That's just, like, the time, I think.
I know.
It was the zeitgeist, although...
It was the zeitgeist, but those bongos were a little out of control. I liked them. I was into it.
It could be fair to say that Desi Arnaz was in the zeitgeist, and hence...
He was.
Contributed to the zeitgeist.
He was the zeitgeist.
So in an indirect, semi-direct way, the bongos in the theme song...
Desi Arnaz is probably cooler than Lucille Ball.
And how does the
could be? I don't know.
Wait, and the I Love Lucy theme song. It goes do 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 do, but then it ends like boo do do boo 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 boo.
That's from the '50s.
But then the Star Trek theme song ends like
do 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 do
boo 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 boo. Yeah. Like, they both end on this, like,
that was,
this,
this
horny kind of, like...
That's how you end a TV show theme song.
How they all did it.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with Desi.
And, you know, it was interesting. Have you ever watched the Star Trek animated series?
Oh, yeah.
The music is, like, all, like, inverted. It's like...
They do that...
Was it unlicensed or something?
Like, no. They just changed up the music.
The theme song to Discovery does some things like that, where they purposely go the opposite direction.
Well, the TNG, like, theme song is from one of the Star Trek movies.
It's from the first Star Trek movie.
Star Trek movie. Yeah, that's right. First one.
So it's discombobulating when you watch Star Trek the Motion Picture... And hear that theme song.
I still
if you don't were used watch to, it. You know, because it's also a different arrangement of the theme song. So if you have the TNG theme song ingrained in your brain,
when you watch
the motion picture, it throws you off a little bit.
I still haven't watched the original Star Trek all the way through. So
the director's cut's pretty good. The ending is like a pretty awesome ending, actually.
Like, was the director's cut ending different, or is it the same?
No, but like it is just. They tighten up a few things. I think the director's cut might actually be technically longer because I think they add in a few things and extend a couple things. They
Director's cut often is longer.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but the rub always on Star Trek the Motion Picture was always that it was kind of plodding.
Yeah.
Which is not inaccurate necessarily, but I don't think it's uninteresting. It's not, you know, I'm a big fan of 2001, but it doesn't go to like that level. It veers in that direction. But
it's not, yeah, it's not like 2001.
It's interesting cuz The Cage had like, it was Star Trek, but there was something, the vibe was different. I mean, obviously, like, the entire cast, except for freaking Spock.
You get closer to that mic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't, in my head, it's like loud as shit.
The cast is interesting, like, because it has, like Majel Barrett is, like, the first officer.
Which volume knob is mine? Because it's, like, super loud three, when I get close.
Three, I think.
Hello. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Major what?
Majel Barrett. Is, Majel you know, Barrett. Like Lwaxana Troi.
And the voice of the computer.
And the voice of the computer. Like, what? She's number one in The Cage. That's number one. That's Lwaxana.
That's Lwaxana Troi?
Yes.
That's Mrs. She's Roddenberry? Is that Roddenberry?
Yes. Yeah, she was married to Gene Roddenberry.
That's her.
I don't know if she was married then to Gene Roddenberry.
That's Lwaxana Troi.
She's also somebody in the medical staff in the original series later on.
Yes. Yeah.
Some sort of doctor. Somebody.
Yes.
Christine.
Christine Chapel, I think.
Yes. So, like...
this is a time to have notes.
Kirk calls her number one, which makes sense. But yeah. Spock also calls her number one.
No, Pike calls her.
I'm sorry. Pike, that's what I meant to say. I'm sorry. That's what I meant. I didn't fuck up. I meant that.
That's all right.
No, I didn't.
It's sort of
But no, Pike says number one, but then Spock calls her number one, and isn't it like the captain calls him number one, and everyone else just calls him, like, sir or lieutenant or whatever.
Yeah
it was like they sort of had that, they were going with that for the show, so everybody was calling them.
They do that, they do a gag on that in season two of Discovery where that character is in that show, but like they only refer to her as number one.
Mm.
And it's almost on, like, pointedly.
It's a nod.
They make a point, like the absence of the name is accentuated in how they
I came up with funny things about The Cage that I noticed. A couple of funny things. Okay, so like, it starts off on the bridge, and like when Pike leaves the bridge, first you see this corridor outside the bridge, and there's these two people walking down the corridor, and they're just dressed in like regular clothes. Like there's a dude in like shorts, and there's like he's with this girl, and she's in a skirt, and it's just like they're off to the beach, like in the '60s or something.
Yeah,
and then like Pike comes out off the bridge and like walks down the hallway.
Yeah, no, there's a bunch of funny stuff. Well, I guess the first thing would be, did you enjoy it? Did you like it? What was
I liked overall? It a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I liked it
it's
a
like
lot,
It's
like
a
too.
Really good episode. I watched it three times, and I liked it a lot more, even like the third time.
I thought it was interesting because cool. They, like, comparing it to, for example, Where No Man Has Gone Before. Is that what the title of the other episode
is?
Yeah.
Yeah. The second pilot.
So, yeah, so that one had more of a ensemble feel than The Cage. The Cage didn't, like, The Cage had a really fascinating, like, it had a depth to its, like, it implied a backstory that, I mean, they definitely explained some of it, but it also just sort of implied a whole sort of world that happened that we didn't get to really hear about, and I thought that was interesting. It was sort of like a deep story that was going on in the,
right.
The Cage that I thought
it's a deeper story.
It was much more of a story than the Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Right off the bat, like you see Spock and Kirk, and they're like, and they're hanging out, and they're being friends, like, and that's different. Spock is different in The Cage.
He smiles. He smiles when they go down to the planet. And
oh, yeah.
They
smiles
see
that blue singing plant.
Yeah, the singing plant. He grabs it. He's like, oh.
I made a note of that.
And
yeah.
He's like,
he totally smiles.
And he's like saying, bitching at Kirk about like, or Pike, sorry. Or no, was that? That was Kirk, actually.
That was Pike.
Which is the one who they're playing? He was playing chess with Kirk.
With
he's
her,
playing,
yeah.
Yeah, in the yeah, when they're all buddies and they're playing chess.
Right, he was kind of like all smug and shit, and I in a more emotional way than I think Vulcans usually.
And he's wearing
but,
a funny shirt. And
but,
looks weird.
But like in The Cage, he's like more like yelling, and he seems a little more panicked when bad shit's going on and stuff like that. And so,
well, they hadn't figured out a couple things about it. His character. One thing is they refer to in The Cage, they make a reference, I believe it was in The Cage, to one of his ancestors being human,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to his mother.
Right. So, oh no, that's in Where No Man Is
Gone.
Isn't
that the second one?
They say something about like, you know, one of my ancestors married a human woman.
He's in a different position, right?
Earth woman.
So he's given more authority in Where No Man Has Gone before. In the cage, he's clearly like right up there.
He's not number one.
But he's not number one.
He's kind of number one in the second.
And it makes sense when you think about it, because in the cage it's almost, I mean, I don't know, but it seems almost more accurate to actual military exercise, which is, you know, the captain leaves the first officer in charge of the ship, while he and the team, the science officer, et cetera, and go and do stuff. Whereas in the Kirk era, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, they're just all down there hanging out.
Yeah.
Pike is more physically sexier than Kirk.
I was just going to say, like, one of my notes, just says dreamy blue eyes.
Yeah, he's really,
he's a little dreamier. He is.
I thought it was funny. The doctor, as he's like, he hands him the martini, obviously, right? In that one scene where the doctor's
Right.
He's talking about,
is that ice? It's like, well, who wants a warm martini?
Yeah. And then like Pike's all talking about, well, maybe I'll be an Orion trade or something. He's like, what? Go trade in green animal women? It's like, wait a minute.
Well, oh, by the way, okay. So there's so much stuff with the women in this one.
Yeah, there are.
Which is, and it's juxtaposed with the fact that you know, number one as a character, obviously, is one of the reasons why they didn't like the pilot, because they had a female authority figure.
That was gonna mention that. That's pretty advanced for that era.
And they characterized her as being almost emotionless. Mm-hmm. A lot of her characteristics were transposed onto Spock, starting with Where Man No Man Has Gone.
Oh,
before,
that's interesting. Yeah.
Where like they made him more emotionless.
And they really ran with it by making like his whole race of people.
But she was not hysterical. She was not crazy. Mm. So there's that. But then on the flip side is this whole like the pixie-ish.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
One.
The younger.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
she wanted to fuck.
I know. Yeah. And when
referenced near the end of the episode, when what was it? The alien said she has strong,
unusually strong female
female. I was like, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah. But the best part is she's like, which one would you have picked?
Yeah, right.
But so
it's like, whoa,
which was cute.
She's
but
got
I mean,
a snapping pussy.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what's going? What did he mean by that? What I want to know is, I want to know two things about that line about the Talosian saying she has an unusually strong female drive. One thing I want to know is what did the Talosian mean? And the other thing I want to know is what did the writers mean?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Was the Talosian being like she just has strong feminine urges, and were the writers saying like she's got to get it up in her?
Yeah, she just needs dick all the time. She just needs dick. She's one of those women.
Not which I can imagine a woman on writers of that era
right
thinking. Oh, and like all the, you know, the doctor's like a dirty old dude. Like there's like a bunch of dirty old like dudes.
So yeah, so like there's that guy, and then like in the second pilot, like the Hellman chick she's the doctor, right?
Hellman chick?
No, what's her name? Sally Kellerman.
Sally Kellerman. I forget, is she a doctor or is she the scientist?
She's the psychologist. There's a different old dude who's
she's
the doctor.
Yeah, that's right. It's a different old dude. It's because McCoy is not there.
They still don't have McCoy on that episode that they filmed.
Yeah, it's a different doctor. They keep going through doctors.
But the first episode that they aired, in fact, does have McCoy. Is that correct?
Her name is Dane? I can't even remember. Daner? Donor? Denner?
Daner?
Something?
Doner kebab?
Boona badoo. They like all. They're all like talking about ESP in that episode. Like she's like, I scored high on my ESP test. Like what does that even mean?
Yeah, well, that the thing is fascinating about that is when, you know, Star Trek, especially back then, they were all about the science. So
that's pretty like magical for Star Trek.
It is, but when you look at the '60s. That's when ESP was actually still being taken seriously because they were doing scientific tests. They joke on that in Ghostbusters.
Right, in Ghostbusters. Yeah, exactly.
And they're all, the CIA, everyone's thinking, oh, this is going to be the key to winning the Cold War, is we're going to get a bunch of psychic people. The men who stare at goats, etc. It was taken seriously, so Star Trek folded it in as if it was some sort of like cutting edge science. But, you know, you take a bunch of bets, and that was one they lost.
Yeah.
You know, those Russians have been doing witchcraft for years. They're going to beat us on the fucking magic, man. No problem.
Well, they did that somewhere in, I wish I could remember the details, but there's an episode of The Next Generation where Picard is like listing difficult problems, and he's like, think about Fermat's last, might even be Fermat's last theorem, which still isn't solved 700 years later. But then it was like solved like 10 years after that episode. So now if you look at that, so you take a bet sometimes and it doesn't work out. It's okay. It's a TV show.
On the cage, they have like a teletype machine on the bridge.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like they're in fucking had a fax machine. Like the army headquarters in fucking Saigon.
All right. Yeah, right. So yeah. here's a quick exercise. Quick exercise is first, name some things you've already started that were different in the cage from like pretty much everything that came later. And then we'll talk about some stuff that's like surprisingly the same.
The color was different in the cage. It's muted, right? A muted sort of a bland sort of like a navy color, like a World War II color.
Yeah.
Like the second Star Trek is like the 60s, and it's like all these bright colors. It's
color
like,
TV.
Bam. It's like pink and, sorry, I popped that shit. It's like there's like it, the colors are much more vivid and they're much more muted in the cage.
I watched it on Netflix. Didn't they release like a visually redone or a remastered?
That's what's on Netflix, the HD versions.
What did they do? Because like I felt like, did they redo any of the effects or did they just clean up?
No, the effects are redone. So the special effects, all the space shit is basically new.
Okay. Anything I was going to say, because I don't think they did that in the cage, but in Where No Man Has Gone Before, it seemed like, for example, when they were flying into the force field and stuff, I was like, that's what I thought, because I was like, wait a minute, that looks like, compared to the cage, which was, everything was really fucking kind of janky.
Yeah. I mean, the cage didn't even have that much space stuff.
Well, the space stuff, and not to get straight too far away from what we were about to do, but I noticed, like, right off the bat, it was interesting, like, so... Okay, well, first of all, they didn't have the open. I'm sure there's a term for it, but the open narration, in the opening theme, like the credits, they didn't have like the 5-year mission, blah blah blah. No man,
and the letters are different.
No man has gone before.
The letters look different. Mm-hmm. It's a different. This when it says Star Trek, it looks different.
When it zoomed in.
Oh, when it zooms in, and it shows like the
through the window.
That was like really like that was kind of cool, but it's like a different. It's sort of. Paints it in a different light.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like zooming in on the bridge, and then the bridge you can see, you're supposed to be able to see through it and see the crew through it, but it's like totally wacky because they had to superimpose some image over it.
It's all wiggly.
And I liked it, but it was like super, like, it was really jarring.
And when they go to warp speed and then it plays the theme again.
It plays the theme and it's like going.
It has those stars like going around.
Yeah, it's like they switch the focus. They switch the opacity or whatever
right.
So it's like they're focusing on the scene, but in the background there's like a background underlay. I don't know what you call it. The stars.
Vandalay.
The song song is actually called like Among the Stars or something, Out Among the Stars, something like that. Like
that's what
we're gonna give this song a name.
I thought it was funny because they pulsed back and forth between one being the overlay to the beat. Like, it's like, oh, now you see more of space. Now you see the overlay of the scene. Now it's, it was like, that was another kind of like, why did they do that? I don't really know, but
it's called creativity, Dan.
No, I mean, it is creative and I appreciate it.
1960s creativity.
It just seemed, it's funny that it's creativity that I liked and I thought was charming, but I didn't understand why they did it.
I think that... I don't know. It's difficult to get to
it's
say.
It's sort of a stylization.
Yeah, but yeah. I think that there are punctuated periods.
Punctuated periods.
A period is a punctuation.
In various creative arts, I think certainly you see it in film where new technology comes on board, new methods of, you know, distribution, etc., and those result in like a flurry of people playing around with these new things.
Yeah.
And around the time of Star Trek, you had color TV becoming more widespread and popular. Yeah. Hence some of the color design choices. Cameras were still big and bulky, but they were, you know, being able to do more with cameras. On Star Trek itself, they were filming crazy weird sets and things. Like the opening sequence from Star Trek is is interesting in that most of those shows, other than the Twilight Zone, which is the closest next thing, yeah. most TV shows then, you just saw clips from the show. You right, know, Andy Griffith, right. I Love Lucy, etc. You know, there was an animation where there were people just walking down the street. This was a show about space, so what are they going to show? They're just going to show the ship flying around in space. So I figure a lot of it was people just seeing, let's just see what we can do, and some of it was ridiculous.
Yeah. So I mean, I appreciate it. I liked it. Did it, there was also what was it? Oh yeah, it was interesting how, like, whereas in the when they after the pilot, so they didn't have a woman as number one anymore. They still had women around, but somehow, like, so that was obviously, like, you know, that's sexist. Like, oh, we're not comfortable with this woman on the thing. But in the pilot, they made a pointed effort to show that there was a woman. Like, for example, Pike at one point goes like, I can't get used to having a woman on the bridge.
Right, and there's clearly already a woman on the bridge.
Yeah. And he's like,
the next highest ranking officer.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Number one.
And so it's interesting that it's like there was all these sort of like weird and like, you know, green animal women and all this sort of like.
It was the 60s,
well,
man.
Yeah, like, I know, but it was interesting because
it was
then
a bad time.
But it's interesting because it seemed like they cleaned up some of that stuff after the pilot. In one sense, they made it a little bit more like less.
It's
in your face
extreme,
about it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they took a step back by like taking women off the bridge.
Well,
you know
it was about.
So,
but think about it, right? There was a difference between respecting women and respecting women in authority.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's not that there were not strong women characters later in TOS and women with authority in TOS, but clearly it was something that the network had trouble with. But I will say that I think one thing it's important to note is that after Pike is basically kidnapped, and they're having that, they're sitting around the conference table, number one and the other senior staff, I guess. And A, by the way, I wanted to say one thing that was pretty wild is like right in this one, you already have staff sitting around a conference table, coming up, talking very politely, giving different ideas, you know, not fighting or anything. We're just discussing the plan, how to solve the problem. And that's something obviously you see forever in Star Trek after that. It's right there in the very, very first pilot. But what I found really interesting, if you look at that scene, it starts out with number one, you know, and they're kind of reporting back about what happened, what they saw, and the guys start arguing with each other. So it's number one is the only woman there, and then the men are there, and they're sort of arguing with each other. Not arguing, but there's like, what about this? What if we shoot with the lasers? Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
And they're all like talking, and then they all look to number one and they're all like, what should we do?
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you often don't see that on TV today where it's like this group of men are all looking at the woman who is in charge and clearly saying like, you have to lead us, tell us what to do. And then she's like, here's what we're going to do. And she gives a decisive answer. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the scene that made the network uncomfortable because they said, what are you doing here? This group of men blindly following a woman.
I always thought they should have done a better job. Now with those ants, those Talosians, they could make you see what they wanted you to see. Now, does that mean like they could make you think you were touching things you weren't touching because they? Because why didn't they check to see that there was a hole? Because they tried to blow up the door with the laser and it wasn't working, but it probably it did work. But they didn't bother to check. But like, I guess the idea is, well, even if they checked, they wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah, because they're like riding horses and sitting on grass.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point.
Presumably, they can simulate any tactile, auditory, visual.
And then they got all the ships data. All the stuff
that
the computer knew. So they knew about like all those presidents up till Johnson.
Wouldn't
it be funny if they didn't get all the data, so they only got up to like Andrew Jackson?
They got up to like the '60s.
The 1916.
What I have written here, who is
all the computers talk like this?
Who is Dr. Theodore Haskins? I don't know why.
Was that the doctor?
I don't know why.
You just wrote that note?
Yeah.
I wrote a note that I don't remember. I just wrote Ermensch.
Ermensch.
You know, like whenever they go down, whenever they beam down, they like put on those like overcoat things. Did you notice that? Like they put on that same overcoat?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they did.
They do that. I mean, that's something they kind of bring back in some of the later iterations. So, like TNG. Well,
they had funny tricorders. Like they were like especially ornate looking. Did you notice that? They were like kind of wiry.
Mm.
And different than how they looked later.
Yeah. The phasers look a little different too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they're like a lot more like ray gun looking.
The way he fainted when they like pointed the gun at him, that when they stunned him to like bring him in, he like fainted. It looked like Kirk fainting. Like it had the same look to it. I don't know. I think it's just Star Trek has like a certain look, like a
certain faint.
Certain kind of faint. It's like how they have the famous like double-handed punch. Where they do that sort of like hammer punch where they put both their hands together. I read some like silly article about like how it was like, that's like exactly what you don't want to do when you're punching someone. Because you're getting...
Doesn't it just break all your fingers?
Break your fingers.
Yeah, and your strength, most of your strength comes from like having your hips and all that behind it. And when you like put your hands in like the opposite motion like that, it's taking all your strength away. It's like, oh, we're adding more strength because we have two arms. But like, no, you're taking away the power of your hips. So I don't know.
One thing I noticed was when they choose to punish Pike, they want to demonstrate that they can punish him, and they basically put him in hell.
Yeah,
and yeah.
That was creepy as
and
shit.
They refer to it as, the quote is,
fable.
That's a fable from your youth.
Right. What fable is that from?
The Bible. But it's not, it's not from the Bible.
Fable Bible.
Oh, yeah. You know. Okay.
Well, and what's interesting...
It's not really in the Bible.
What's interesting is that, again, they broach that, they touch on that in Discovery, because in Pike's background, they sort of imply like his father might have been religious or something. I mean, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but they discuss that Pike is not coming necessarily from a wholly atheistic worldview, whereas that's kind of how a lot of other folks are portrayed as in the Federation anyway.
Word up.
I haven't written about him. I did note that when they punished him, and like all I basically had written was something the effect of like there was like really hot water and like
he said something about like
I didn't put for whatever reason, now that I look at it, it's very obvious, I didn't put like the hell connection, and I was like, what fable is that from? Because But apparently,
is it because the special effect of his burning skin sloughing off just looked like he was like covered in soap suds?
Was that supposed to be his skin coming off? I thought it was just hot water that he was like sitting in, and he was supposed to be like, water's really hot.
You know, it could be, but I think it was intended to simulate being boiled alive in the flames of hell. Like, yes, with liquid, but also with flames. And
they did a good job of making it creepy to seem like that. Oh yeah, it was.
Oh yeah, it's creepy for sure.
So, like, the Talosians couldn't figure out how to put a human back together, but, like, they look just like humans, except they have the big bulbous heads. Like, what the fuck was that? Like, they couldn't put that chick back together again, like, properly.
I thought that was a pretty good effect where they, like, made her morph from, like, regular to all fucked up.
Oh,
was,
definitely.
That was pretty impressive. I guess they must have just faded between two different overlays or something.
Yeah, just locked the camera down.
Right, yeah.
And then, I mean, they move the camera away when they want to make it super... like they want to move to the next step. There was like three or four stages she went through, but like when you look closely, they do a really good job of fading like her face into that. It's kind of fucked up though, because like, you know, she was like, I can't go back to society because I look all fucked up. And then when Pike beams back to the Enterprise, he was like, she's not coming back, and I agree with her reasons.
I know, right?
It's like, what, because she looks all fucked
up? Again, maybe you guys, like, never once were they like, we can probably help her. We know what humans look like.
Right.
We can totally help. And while I totally understand for story purposes, I've never had a problem with that concept, when they say we don't know what humans look like, clearly they have access to the memories of the humans that they can then use to recreate like these incredibly realistic worlds. So how do they not like get an image of the human? I mean, maybe she's a little brain damaged.
They look just like humans, except they have the big butt head.
Yeah, they have the big booty butts.
They're gross, the veins. The veins in the head like pulsating always kind of ooged me out.
I bet there was a team of 30 men squeezing special bulbs.
I was wondering
to do that.
I was looking at one point. I was looking at his shoulder to see if I could see it tensing up, as if he was like pumping some kind of like thing to make the. Because that's what they do on SNL, basically.
Yeah, I bet somebody else did it. I bet somebody sat below their robes.
So there was like going between both episodes. I feel like, so there was like the weird pig monkey in the cage, when in the cage part of the cage.
Yeah,
when
and,
he
the,
was looking,
and the bird guy.
The weird bird guy. It was funny because the bird guy, they made it, that was moving all slow-mo for some reason. They made that one all jerky and slow-mo.
It was weird. Yeah.
But there was the pig monkey guy, right? It was like, and then like in Where No Man Has Gone Before, this is related. Doesn't sound like it is, but it is. He, when Mitchell, I'm jumping to the end here, when Mitchell starts like getting at Kirk, by the way, William Shatner has got some pretty good like stage combat skills.
Yeah.
He does a good kick-ass roll to shoot before he shoots.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
he does this cool hip toss. But anyways, Kirk's on the ground and like Mitchell's about to like fuck him up. But before he does, Daner, or I think it's Daner, the psychiatrist, she comes up and she zaps Mitchell, right?
Yeah.
And then and Mitchell's like, oh no. And then she like fucks him up and
it's the end of Return of the Jedi.
Exactly. Precisely. It's precisely what it is.
Totally.
And then the pig monkey is like kind of like those, what are those pig soldiers in Star Wars?
Ugnaughts.
Are they Ugnaughts?
I think so.
Lugnuts.
The pig soldiers. So like, I mean, the pig human is like an idea that goes back, you know, because they're so similar. So maybe that part wasn't ripped from. Maybe that wasn't.
Shit.
Yeah, maybe that wasn't ripped from Star Trek. But like, that's what I thought of when I saw that monkey, pig monkey guy. Is I thought of like, well, that's like Star Wars. Well, Star Wars is like that or whatever. But yeah, the Return of the Jedi thing like kind of solidified that idea a little bit for me. So. But they thought that like I had said before, I thought the cage was a really great story. They really, I think, got the ship dynamic, the characterizations and just basically characters interacting with each other and like the group dynamic in the Where No Man Has Gone Before and on. I think they really got that down. Whereas in the cage, it was really, and maybe that's just the nature of how the story was, but like you really didn't get a sense of like this like sort of like, you know, ship, like different characters on a ship so much. It was
They had to make it more interesting. So like it's like brighter, it's more colorful. There's like the people on the show are like, well, it's on sort of a little bit more of an ensemble, like these people are buddies. It's not like everybody's just working together on a ship.
Yeah, and they had more like character appeal to them. Like there was really solid character in like Pike wasn't, I mean, he was great, but I didn't get a vibe that he was like a real.
Well, the show also, that episode focuses almost entirely on Pike. Mm-hmm. So he's the most developed of the characters. And Spock has some interesting bits here and there, but he's, you know, proto Spock at that stage. But what about the, like, because the thematic elements of the cage, to back up, one of the issues that the studio supposedly, or the network supposedly, had with the cage is that they thought it was quote unquote too cerebral, you know, which I always thought, did they just didn't like the big butthead people? It's like, did they mean that literally? But but they seem to think it was like too high-minded or whatever. But the thing is that where No Man Has Gone Before definitely has a little bit more action and drama. But it's still a pretty high-minded. It's about a guy who gets god powers.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, it's a pretty high-level.
And you're basically watching these characters. These basically him. He's the main character that develops, and then there's a lesser development of Daner in that one too. But maybe Mitchell, like, yeah, he's basically. It's like you're slowly over time seeing her come around to his shenanigans. You know, she takes the trip. Like she's resistant, but then she kind of like sympathizes with him a little
bit.
She
likes that shit.
And and she makes a slow move to that, and he makes that slow move. So they
both. Well, she got zapped too.
So that, yeah, they both got. Well, the point is that, like, they did a great. Like, what Patrick was saying is, like, it was. They did a good. It was. You saw this slow progression. It wasn't just like they got zapped and, oh, all of a sudden they look. Yes, they got zapped and that's what began their journey. But, like, it wasn't like they got zapped and suddenly they were acted like god, like you know, childish gods or whatever. It's like, yeah, you saw the progression, which is pretty high-minded, yeah, to think of, like, what they must be going through. And then the other characters to sort of predict, like, well, what's going to happen when he becomes a god? We're just going to be, like, a bunch of mice to him or something, you know?
Well, I mean, so, you know, as we ease into that the discussion of that episode, with the cage, I was thinking that, you know, we already discussed how there's the whole number one issue and that might have made the network a little nervous. And I think another thing is that Captain Pike, I mean, the episode starts with Captain Pike sort of complaining about being a starship captain and being somewhat, I can't remember if he was bored or what, but he, you know.
He was bummed
out.
They
just had some kind of, they had just like done some kind of action.
Yeah, there was
like,
some war stuff.
People had died.
People
and
died
stuff.
And he was like fucking sick of it all.
Yeah.
Because that one chick that's like the new chick on the bridge, she was like a replacement for somebody.
That's right. Mm. Well, she, and that's sort of a, that's a vaguely anti-war, very hippie-ish kind of message that maybe they were a little uncomfortable with, because, you know, at least at the beginning, there's plenty of anti-war stuff in the remainder of TOS, but Kirk is certainly more gung-ho, and in fact, all the crew are pretty darn gung-ho about being there and doing the job.
I think the issue of too like cerebral, at least with where No Man has gone before, at least when you're watching these people sort of progress to this god status, like it's getting involved with a character. It starts off as a relatable person and it turns into someone just completely unrelatable, but still having aspects of it that still remain relatable as a human. So you can lose yourself in that character without having to think too deeply about it. The thing with the cage is it was a whole story and it presented a whole backstory. And like the Talosians were just sort of like uncaring, unfeeling looking things, sort of examining humans like they were bullshit or whatever. And so that was more of like, yeah, just a straight story with like this sort of implied like whole other background that you could make a sideshow, you know, a spinoff about, like the whole Talosian, like the wars that went on at that planet and stuff. So I can see like whenever you get like this sort of idea where you have to empathize with characters and things like that, and you have to feel yourself in their place, that's sort of hitting on a part of us when we watch that it's, we can feel it and we can think about it, but it's much easier to sort of get lost into sort of the emotion of it.
You know, it could just be that is a problem that Roddenberry had, that when he's left largely to his own devices, as in the cage, as in the Star Trek, the motion picture, as in the, you know, Encounter at Farpoint, the pilot to TNG, it could be that left to his own devices, he goes too broad, too high-minded, strays too far from the character and emotion. And the thing about the character and the emotion, the reason they work is they're shorthand for more complex things. So really well-written characters, they can get the message across more effectively and more efficiently, because instead of having to explain it by the structure of the story, they explain it by the look they have on their face, or the poetic thing they say in response to something, or how they react to something says the same thing that Roddenberry might take a couple pages of emotionless alien standing there and lecturing, you know, for.
Right. And you can sort of apply your own sort of like way you would handle such a situation if you were in that role, which makes it relatable and sort of slightly different depending on who you are viewing it. It's funny, because I've been watching Party Down. The
show is amazing.
The show is really good. It took me, I liked it from the start, but it took me a little while to really get into it. Now it sucks because I'm like halfway through the second season. I'm like, oh man. But I just saw an episode it was with Steve Guttenberg, and he was, and he was like helping Roland, Martin Starr's character, I think it's Roland, because he's all into like, Roland is like into writing hard sci-fi, and so like Steve Guttenberg is insisting that they like play out his writing, because Guttenberg's all super supportive of like everyone and everything in that episode, and he's also kind of a weirdo too in his own right, but yeah, it's funny because like when they initially do Martin Starr's, because you were talking about Gene Roddenberry, when they originally do Roland, Martin Starr is scene, it's like really unrelatable, and it's really just like a bunch of like sciencey, like, you know, sort of like words and sciencey words, and
science,
and there's just kind of, you're just kind of like ugh. And then like, you know, Steve Guttenberg rewrites it and adds all this these characters, you know, this one's dying and this other one's in love with that one and all this, and then like even Roland's like, wow, that was really good, you know? So yeah, maybe there was a little bit of that going on. But at the same time, I didn't, you know, obviously that was an exaggeration, because I really enjoyed the cage. I was really into that, like that sort of idea is like, wow, there's this like whole, you really got this sort of vibe of like, there's this whole race of Talosians and there's this whole history with them and there's all this shit went down on this planet.
And they're like, living underground. They're trying to breed new, like they want the humans to be basically, it's like, the question, this is the question of the slavery aspect, right? Because they're kidnapping people and they want to breed them to work their planet now that their planet is slowly recovering and they want them to make their planet recover more quickly and better so the Talosians can basically have a civilization continue, right? That's fucked up. But it's like some super fucked up shit. Yeah. And I love the fact that in the story, the Talosians are not in any way shown to be evil or anything. They're, from their perspective, it's perfectly reasonable. They're like, well, we can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do this. And in the end, there's no guarantee that they're going to stop their plans. It's not like, it's not like Pike won in the end. Yeah. All he did was win freedom for himself by being sort of obnoxious. Well, and they were like, this guy's too difficult to deal with. We're going to have to go to plan B and they'll go grab some Klingons or something.
Right. Well, and so like Pike sort of like was the representation of that. But ultimately, as the episode sort of kind of, it's funny, like, he could have gotten free regardless of what he did because what set them over the edge was all the history they read about the humans.
Yeah.
They were like, we read your history. You guys are too fucked up, man.
Yeah, you guys are pieces of shit.
So did Pike even really do anything to get his freedom?
No,
but he like represented what that history is.
They only read
so.
Like up to the 60s. They didn't even read the shit that came after.
Yeah, right.
I've heard that argument before. But that's also, they talk about that in like Blade Runner and a couple, there's a few movies where, or like Indiana Jones, where nothing they do, the main character does actually affects the end, the plot in the end. Like everything that happens would have happened whether or not the main character was involved. I think Indiana Jones is one of those movies. It doesn't make it a bad movie. It's just a weird quirk of the writing. But I have a question, a sidebar question. Clearly, kidnapping humans, trying to force them to mate and breed a new population, bad plan. They decided correctly that wasn't going to work. Do you have a recommendation for which Star Trek alien species they should have gone after?
Wow.
So Klingons are probably a bad idea.
Klingons would have... They're talking about violence.
What about the Bolians?
Which one were the Bolians? I can't even remember which one the Bolians were.
Aren't they the... Isn't that like Mott the barber? The ones that are bald and blue?
Mr. Mott.
I look at Google, it says Boolean. Wait, Boolean?
The Boolean. Hey, you can marry, you can date a Boolean, but you just don't marry it, okay?
Oh,
I'm
right.
Comfortable with you dating a Boolean.
Yeah, right. The barber. Yeah, I was thinking for some reason Phlox when I was like, he's not a barber. No, yeah, the Boolean. Do you really ever get much of an idea of what they are? What about Morn? Morn.
Oh, yeah, no, Morn.
I get a feeling that race secretly can fuck people up somehow, though.
Morn's, I think so. Race. Well, the gag with Morn, of course, is that he was a chatty Cathy that would never shut
right.
up.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's hard to... So, they give some hints, I guess, as to... So, okay.
Y'all got any hints?
Well, when they had them, when they had them Pike captive, they were like, well, their intelligence is shockingly limited. But they also said that they are highly adaptable and they have excellent memory capacity. So you're impressed by their adaptability and their memory capacity, but you still say their intelligence is shockingly limited. So I don't know what fits that boat for an alien.
Well,
race.
I mean, intelligence can be measured in different ways, and clearly
it's the human condition.
They meant
the human condition.
They were implying. I mean, I'm guessing that they were implying by intelligence they meant like just the speed and processing power, and you know, they're obviously not psychic and telekinetic. You know, they
right.
So
yeah.
So they have limits compared to them. But on the other hand, they might be more adaptable. I mean, this is an alien race that does not seem to be particularly adaptable since they screwed up their planet. And they adapted by moving underground. Good for them. But
and
that's,
then becoming rapists.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, and don't forget, we saw that they had a menagerie. That's why the later episode that you know, cannibalizes the cage. It's called the menagerie, but they
mentioned they say the menagerie in that episode, but in the episode the cage, he talks about a menagerie, and I was like, he said the thing that they probably
and we see some of it. We see some of those creatures vaguely hinted at. It would have been interesting to see some more, to see what other things they were kind of experimenting around with and for what purpose.
So looking at the different races, I'm thinking about, so like, you know, Bajorans were historically, you know, enslaved, but I don't think that would be good because they're feisty, you know.
Are you suggesting Bajorans are highly enslavable?
I mean, I felt like it was controversial to even bring it up, but
well, I mean, forget about the slavery aspect. Just like, obviously, it's taken for granted that it would be an act of violence to kidnap people and populate a planet. But in theory, they do it. A few generations pass, and they trick everybody somehow so that the generations that are thriving don't think of themselves as slaves. They just think of themselves as living and farming on this planet and occasionally helping out the creepy old butthead people.
I'm going to go with the most the race that they should have picked would have been the Ferengi, I think. Because the Ferengi, all you would have to do is make them think they were rich. And like they'd probably just be like, "Well, I know I'm not really rich, but I might as well be rich."
Yeah,
you know,
Ferengi can be very hard workers.
And as long as you can give the illusion that they're like, you know, they're already enslaved by capitalism, man.
The Ferengi might be slightly obnoxious in the sense that they all might try to sexually harass the Talosians. Yeah, because they got, because the Ferengis kind of have a butthead thing going too, mm-hmm. and they might be like, "Ooh, tiny ears, but that's a big cranial knob."
Oh yeah, they might feel threatened.
I think they dig it.
I just think that kind of like, what's his name from The Matrix, Joe Pantaleone,
Joey Pants,
Cypher.
Yeah,
he was like, "I know this is all bullshit, but I want to like." Pretend that I'm living a wonderful, real, amazing life, but I don't care if it's bullshit. Do the Ferengi really care if, like, all their hot women are, like, you know, made up? Do they care if, like, all the land they own? What?
Oh, you mean the? Oh, I got you. So, you're like, they would be cool with it.
Yeah, the Talosians would give them everything they want. Like, mentally, they would make the illusion that they have everything they want.
You know, I think yes, but. Given that this is Star Trek, I think if that were the case and it were successful, there would be like some episode of Star Trek where one of the resulting Ferengi, like 10 generations down the line, would be like, "I don't know if we should be happy with this."
Hmm.
And would like make a big deal.
Yeah, but who? But the question of which race would work best, I mean, who could be better? Who would be better than the Ferengi then, you know?
I'm concerned about the Ferengis. I don't know. I just don't know enough about their agricultural and industrial capacity. They're very clever people.
Right. We don't know enough about like how things actually function.
We know they're good with like technology and stuff. I don't know. I mean,
so in order to be enslaved by the Talosians to help the Talosians get whatever the Talosians want done, we want a race that's going to be most willing to succumb to like bullshit, right?
I think that's a good point.
Like the Ferengi are all about like cutting a bunch of deals and you know, like making profits, but doesn't it seem like there'd be like some other people that are doing like the work for the Ferengi? Because they're like super capitalist, so somebody's eventually going to get like, you know,
that maybe that's an angle. Maybe that's where the Talosians made the mistake. They tried to create their own population when they should have just hired some Ferengi, like the equivalent of a real estate agent, because the Ferengi would be like, "I know a guy who knows some
right.
people."
Well,
why did the Talosians want the humans in the first place to make a race of people, make a civilization of people to like mine the fields for them, basically? Is that what they want?
That was the way they described it is you will have a new Eden and you'll start a whole new group of people. Because
they happen to have another human already.
Yeah, what did they want? Did they, and like there weren't, I mean, how many Talosians were there? And were there female Talosians?
Like three or four.
They wanted them, so the deal was that the Talosians, this might be some flaw in the writing, I can't quite remember.
Yeah, because
they
never really got the full gist of their motivation.
The implication, which is maybe giving them too much of the benefit of the doubt, but the implication is, well, what they described was catastrophe implied maybe wars and ecological shit, and then they have to go underground, and that's where they move their civilization, and they're like, they ended up becoming super smart, which is great, and over the period of time that they were underground, like, whatever horribleness was going on above ground, like, dissipated at least somewhat, and was now to the point where you could start to do something. But the problem was, is they'd been underground so long that they turned into brainy mega dudes, and no longer had the capacity to do the hard work of replanting basically of almost terraforming their planet to fix it.
You're too addicted to mind rape.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Like the mind rape in terms of effort and enjoyment better than farming.
So they just needed people to farm for them, basically.
Yes, and I'm using farming as a shorthand because I think farming is included, but the implication also was we've got like some animals and shit, we've got some cool plants and shit, we want you to go plant that shit around. So plant it all around the thing. So not just like planting like corn or whatever, Quadra triticale. It's not like they were just going to be like growing quadra triticale. Fields of quadra triticale just from here to the horizon. There might have been that, but they also wanted them to like go around planting plants and like creating little ecosystems so that the planet would be nice, and then the Telosians would then come out of the caves and be like, kick ass, our planet is all super chill and nice, and we didn't have to do the work. We let these dudes do the work, and we treated them nice in the process. But like they were strong and muscular. And slavery.
The implication though was like it's slavery, except we'll give you all of your wishes, all your indulgences you could imagine. All like you know, like,
they were offering that. Yeah,
yeah, they were offering that. And I guess they would offer that to as many people as needed it. So would that be enough to motivate like the Ferengi, or would you need a race that needed to be like more like pounded into submission, you know? I don't know.
Or you get a group like the Cardassians, where as long as you can convince them it's like good for their culture somehow.
Oh yeah.
Like they'll organize very quickly and get shit done.
See, the Telosians didn't seem subtle enough to sort of get the idea of creating like a motivational, like they were having problems with motivating. Their motivation was pretty much limited to like, we'll give you like some people to fuck and some delicious food and some fun shit to do and place to live.
They were basically being condescending and insulting.
Yeah, that's probably, their,
yeah, it's what it is.
No.
It's like when the guy trying to molest you, you know,
mm-hmm.
is like, yeah, you know, you want some candy?
Yeah.
You want some cash? And it's you're like, no, man, yeah. Give me a fucking Nintendo 64.
Yeah, you know.
Come on, man.
Right.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Candy bar? I can get my own fucking candy bar.
That guy in Different Strokes that tried to molest Arnold?
Yeah, he had a bike.
Yeah.
Gordon Jump.
What?
The actor's name was Gordon Jump.
Gordon Jump.
He's been in other shit, right?
He was in Seinfeld, and like the last season he was George's boss.
Who was the guy in Webster who played Webster's like, estranged father who was a diabetic, and then...
I don't remember.
And then George thought he was a heroin junkie, but then he was like, I'm a diabetic, George. I don't know. Anyways, that's kind of neither here nor there. It's true.
I don't think I watched a lot of Webster.
I watched a good amount. I mean,
I think I watched more Different Strokes.
I watched them both.
So we have to talk a little bit. We got to wrap it up soon, but we got to talk a little bit about
wrap it up.
Where No Man Has Gone Before. Which we've already, of course.
Oh, by the way,
a topic.
Yeah.
Any closing initial thoughts about the cage?
Two things. I want to know who the actor was that played that like barbarian warrior that Pike like had apparently fought, because he looked like fucking what's his name from 007. Who's that guy? Sawface or
Kalar thing?
Who's that guy from 007 for James Bond movies? Who the Sawface, tooth mouth, metal metalhead?
Jaws? Right, that guy.
Jaws. Yeah, he looked like him, but probably
metalhead. Isn't that
he's a Ninja Turtle?
Yeah. I was going to say, as a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I will see if I can find out who plays that character.
And the other thing is, I swear that the alien dude was a little wall-eyed, and the woman, crashed woman girl, was like kind of cross-eyed. I think she was cross-eyed. She was a little bit cross-eyed. I kept looking at her. I was like, your eyes look... You look beautiful and everything.
I think that was the thing back then.
Does it have a little bit of cross-eyed?
Yeah.
Kind of like a cat that's a little cross-eyed. It's cute.
You know? Now, Dan, the person you were looking for, was it the anthropoid ape? Humanoid bird?
The anthropoid ape. Yeah, that was the one that was comparing to when Star Wars.
Yeah, that was played by Janos Prohaska.
No, but that's Janos. Janos.
Janos.
But that's
Janos.
Not the person I was asking
you
about. I was talking about
someone else. Was it called
the barbarian
Kalar? The Kalar.
Yeah, Kalar.
Yeah,
the Kalar.
That's
the
giant.
That giant dude, and he like stabbed him in the butt or something.
Let me see here. It says Michael Duggan,
Michael
and that name is familiar.
And then Hacksaw King Jim Duggan.
The Destructors, Andy and Clyde. Let me see.
Oh, and also I have to make a note that this is, and I have the timestamp because it's amazing.
You don't have to.
I have to because it's amazing, and I even paused and took pictures of it. At 24 minutes and 24 seconds, Vina, that's right, Vina, she makes an amazing face. Like, it's the most out of place, jarring, hilarious, like, almost like Valley Girl kind of, like, humorous, but supposed to not be humorous.
What's the context around it?
They're in fantasy land, and she's trying to convince Pike that he wants to be with her, and they're in like fantasy world.
Were they in that park?
This was before she fought the Kalar. Is that what she said, Jesse? It's Kalar?
Oh, yeah. So I think it's a Kalar.
Kalar. That's where they were. They were in that scene before they appeared, and there was like that castle in the background or whatever. And he's like, where are we? Oh, no, we're here or whatever. And she's like, yo, no, the guy's here. Blah, blah. And you hear a roar in the background. It's like
Rigel.
And it's all like, roar. And there was some kind of noise in the background. And she looks at him and makes this winky face. It's like, and then she like turns around. I have a picture of it, which does not do anyone any good. But,
we'll post it on the informational feed.
Right.
But the picture doesn't even do it justice. You have to see that 1 second. It goes roar, and she goes like,
"All right, listeners, everybody, Dan's going to give the timestamp again. We're going to make note of it because everybody, it's an assignment. You have to see this.
See, it's
everybody
on Netflix.
It makes
or
it
wherever.
It makes it the podcast."
Interactive?
Interactive. I was going to say interactionable, and I was like, that's not the word I'm looking
for. We can sue you.
Interjectionable.
Interjectionable. It makes it feel like people feel like they're really here. Anyway, so yes, 24 minutes and 24 seconds.
24 minutes and 24 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And 24-24?
24-24, 24-24.
That is very easy to remember, folks.
It is. And
at home, jogging at the office, driving into work, sitting on the subway, trying to ignore the guy next to you. 24:24 Netflix, anywhere you want to go, that is going to get you to this scene.
24:24 for our international listeners.
Yes. In Spanish, the international language. Ubiquitous international language. In fact, they call
English
it
English is the international.
No. The Spanish is the lingua franca.
Also, when the Talosians were looking at them on the TV, that TV looked like the TV out of Space Ghost Coast to Coast.
Yeah, it did. That's good.
It was awesome. It's like, what the fuck? I think that's cool. Age morph. It wasn't age morph. It was a fucked up face morph. Yeah, I think that's all. But they did a really good job of it. I was actually amazed. It might have been really simple, but it looked really good. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, so if we're moving on to Where No Man has gone before.
At 4108, they say menagerie. Okay, I'm sorry.
That episode is like an hour or 3 minutes.
Yeah, it's a long one. In Where No Man Has Gone Before, another episode I liked quite a bit. I thought the story was good. And, you know, you already mentioned Kirk's awesome, you know, Shatner's awesome moves and wiggles and wangles. They started getting Spock, you know, closer to real Spock.
He was closer, but he was still, they had the Vulcan smugness, but he was still a little too emotional about a smugness, I thought. But
yeah.
They were much more Spock vibe.
He was wearing a yellow shirt and he had a lot of sort of yellowy makeup on.
Yeah, they did. They didn't switch. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just realized that was an asshole thing for me to say. He's like, Spock was a little too emotional, you know? It's like, they fucking made the show. I didn't make the show. I'm an asshole. I'm sorry.
Well, we know you meant in relation to where the character ended up.
Yeah, it was still in development. I mean, that was like the first episode of Star Trek as we know it.
And, you know, a lot of what we got, and, you know, Roddenberry did a good job responding to the network concerns, and, you know, he caved to a few things. He squeezed in a couple other things because the story, as we said, was still very, you know, high-minded and interesting with the whole absolute power stuff. But I think one interesting thing I noticed while watching it was that it's the first example of the pretty common Trek trope where they encounter some sort of situation that was faced by somebody else before them.
Oh, yeah.
Who failed, mm-hmm. and then using clues that they find, they manage not to fail this time around.
There's a lot of episodes.
And like so there was a bunch in the original series, TNG. like The Naked Now, The Arsenal. Well, The Naked Now is another big good one in TOS, but TNG did this shit all the time. So they did it in The Naked Time, which is a remake of The Naked Now, basically. They did it in The Arsenal of Freedom, Contagion, The Royale, Time Squared, Booby Trap, Night Terrors, Identity Crisis, Cause and Effect. I mean, there's tons more than that, but like...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was really trying to like get the pronunciation of Daner right. I think it was
Is that
Daner.
Right? Daner?
I'm trying to find it, and I'm just trying to do it in a way that wasn't going to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
But I'm just saying that's it was kind of interesting to see that, because it's like, okay, they've arrived somewhere, like some communications went dead, they're trying to figure out what happened, mm-hmm. they figure out what happened and it's bad, but then it starts happening to them,
right?
And then they have to like race against the clock to like figure out, and so much of the dialogue, especially between Kirk and Spock, was really interesting, because Kirk was like, we got to do this, and then Spock was like, you know, that's what they tried, and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, you got to kill this motherfucker.
Yeah, when Kirk finds
Spock's ready to kill that dude.
Yeah, when Kirk like calls up and is like, they said they like beam down like a space ray gun, a laser rifle. That's what it was, a laser rifle.
Phaser rifle.
Yes, phaser rifle.
The first and only time you see that in the original series.
It's pretty
badass.
Only time.
It was badass. But like when Kirk's like, he's like, what? I didn't order it. And then he sees it and he's like, ugh. And he's like, just puts the tricorder on. You can tell he's pissed. But at the same time, he doesn't question it. He's just like, Spock's gonna, he like respects Spock enough that he's not gonna like be like, fuck you, man. But he's also like, you can just tell he's pissed by it.
Yeah.
And Spock is blatantly just like, I'm just gonna do this. You know?
Well, and I think one angle, it's a silly angle, but I think it's funny just because it popped into my head while I was watching this. The Spock is being logical. He's noting, okay, this guy has god powers now, and he's acting like a threatening lunatic. We have to do something about it. It's a danger to the ship. It clearly was a danger to that, you know, to whatever went on, to the previous ship. So you got to kill him. It logically makes sense. That's a perfectly viable perspective. The other perspective is that fucking Spock had it up to fucking here with this best buddies, Gary Mitchell and James Kirk. And Spock is like, come
jealous.
On. Spock is like, I want to play some fucking 3D chess without being bothered by this piece of shit Gary Mitchell, who, by the way, was kind of an asshole at the beginning
of
the episode.
Walking freezer unit, is he called?
Yeah, and you know,
and when she gave a line back at me, he's like, "Hoo hoo, got a live one, basically."
Yeah, you know? I mean, he's kind of a cocksucker.
Yeah, right.
He's kind of an asshole, but
and Spock's like, "I've been awesome this whole fucking time."
Yeah,
and I have to deal with this fucking
But Spock was totally friend zoned by Kirk and like Gary Mitchell. He's like, Spock is like, he doesn't treat you well, James.
Yeah, right.
He talks shit behind your back. Come on, you know.
Well,
but I found it an interesting angle to take, because, and you know, I know I'm exaggerating, but he was kind of, they made Gary Mitchell to be an abrasive sort of cocky, you know, charming in that kind of asshole way, which, you know, it's fine.
Well, he scored highest on the ESP of all the shit.
Well, yeah, so that means he's a complete piece of shit.
Yeah,
but the fact that they chose to start with that when they could have started, and I think if this was like, if they had written it in the same style as they had written the cage, they would have started the character as more perfect. They would have had like a really ideal character who then becomes an asshole, because that strengthens the argument. The argument is that absolute power corrupts absolutely. It strengthens it if you take a truly good person, and by the end of the episode, they have to be killed because they've gone bad.
And once again, is it a difference in the writing, or is it just the way the story lends itself? Because in the cage, there was really no character development at all, really. It was just kind of like, this is this philosophy, this is that philosophy, these are the things that are testing those philosophies.
I think it's an example of, that's the sacrifice you make to get the improvements you can get to the story from adding character traits, meaningful, relatable character traits. They can detract from the purity of the thematic message. Now, the argument many, myself included, would make is that that's fine because the purity of message is rarely interesting. It might be interesting in the abstract, but it's not as interesting as actually seeing a realistic version of the story play out, which is going to have more impact, because it's like, what has more impact? You see a nun, she gets god powers, and then she like, you know, shoots lasers at her fingers and gets shot. And
fucks a bunch of little
Or
boys.
A guy who's exactly like a guy you know,
right,
and want to hang out with and get beers with. Maybe you were that guy. Maybe you looked up to that guy in high school and wanted to hang out with him. Maybe you were one of those guys' underlings. Yeah. So that's more relatable to see that person that you're like, you're into, you respect, and then like, then they go bad.
And then, and also that relatable person still remains relatable in the sense that they are still have human desires. As Kirk said, like a god with all the human frailties or something like that. Some line like with all the something about human frailties and motivations or something, but it was a tight line that he gave about it. And basically saying like, yeah, he's different. He's bad. He's a god now, but he's still got these human traits. So he still remains just a little bit relatable. Yeah. You can still picture yourself in that scenario.
And the other thing is that, and Star Trek has done this a lot throughout its tenure, but this is right at the beginning where, and in some ways similar to the Talosians, but I think it's better here where Gary Mitchell's, what he's saying all kind of makes sense. And he, even at one point towards the end, is like, no, it makes sense for you to kill me.
Yeah.
Obviously, that makes sense. I'm smart. I'm a super genius now. And that's the right answer. The right answer is for you to try to kill me, because how can the universe exist with somebody like me in it? That doesn't stop him from proceeding and using his powers to, and you know, it keeps going down the train tracks a little bit, and it doesn't end up too well for him. But it's an interesting thing that like he even admit, he's not like some powerful god who says like, you all are wrong. He's like, no, you guys are 100% correct. Yeah. Good on you. You're more clever than you look like.
So, quick aside, that when he made the grave for Kirk, his name was James R. Kirk. Isn't it supposed to be James T. Kirk? Like, I mean, I'm guessing that changed.
I don't know what you're talking about, man.
Didn't it say the grave? I paused it and I looked at it.
No, you're wrong about that.
It said James.
That would invalidate all of everything that came after. That would be invalidated.
Ribius so. Kirk? Like, what is...
Ribius.
Ribbit.
I just noticed that apparently...
Riberius Kirk.
James. I'm not.
It's not a complaint. It's just I wonder at what point they decided.
No,
to change
I think
it
to it's. James T. Kirk. I like it. I like it because I love Star Trek. I enjoy Star Trek. It's fun to talk about the continuity.
No, I'm not like bitching about it. I just thought it was interesting to note.
I'm being rhetorical. Okay. I'm saying I like that it's there because that can always be pointed at. If somebody gets a little bit too serious about the nitpicking.
Right.
Because it's like, it's a fucking TV show.
Right. I'm curious what I was more curious what the R was supposed to stand for. Like, what was his middle name?
I bet that information is out there.
It's got to be. Why else would they put an R there?
Well, if you're listening at home, you please look it up and email it to us, because we don't.
I think it's Ribius.
We don't know how to do Google.
Nope.
Go.
Well, but leading Ribbius. Up to this final scene where
James Randolph Kirk.
Where Kirk was meeting with Mitchell. I keep thinking of like, what was it? Was at the House of Cosby's. The main character was named Mitchell in the House of Cosby's. Yeah. It's like, hey, Mitchell. I think it was House of Cosby's. It was one of those Justin Roiland productions. But like Kirk was talking about like, so originally they were just going to strand this guy on like, they were, you know, they were going to like.
It was, yeah, it was like that automated. Mining.
Yeah, they were just gonna like leave him there, and it's like, you're just gonna leave this guy there? I mean, is that really? They know he knows
a common thing. They did the same thing with Khan.
Yeah, I guess
you're
right.
That didn't work either.
But Khan didn't have the potential to be like omnipotent.
And they
like,
also had other people. And with like, Khan.
When they go to that planet, like Kirk's all like, it's just us chickens.
Yeah, I was like, yeah. That too.
Ain't
like,
nobody here but us chickens.
Yeah, is that a thing that people say?
It was like a song.
Oh, okay.
It's a song by Louis Jordan.
And that scene, by the way,
ain't nobody here but us
that,
chickens.
That, not even that scene, that brief segment reminded me of the Orville. It reminded me of something that you know, Captain Mercer would say, you know, Seth MacFarlane, when he like goes down to a planet, he would say something like that. You know, it's like this weird thing where it's like, we've arrived on the planet. I was like, dot, 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 you know, like, yeah. I'm going to say something about this planet.
I actually had in my notes, I just wrote the Orville, because there was some parts about the Orville that looked like he definitely like referenced, like looked like straight up happened in the Orville. Anyway, so first of all, back to that scene, that was pretty awesome. I thought the backdrop they had when they were standing out, first they land on the planet and you just see the backdrop, and then you see them up close, and then right before that, after he says just us chickens or whatever, right before or during, you see the backdrop with them standing there, and that's for just a couple seconds, and it's really neat to try to, it's really hard to get that perspective to like, even though it's right there, it's hard to picture it working.
You see that in the closing credits for the other episode.
Yeah, and so even if so, it makes me want to just pause and look at it and try to like, it's just a really neat sort of how it all works together. It's interesting in the, speaking of the closing credits, they show scenes from The Cage actually in
closing credits. Yeah.
But so what basically they were going to strand Mitchell on the planet, some guy who's going to be all powerful, but Kirk like eventually comes to his senses more and is like, just nuke the fucking planet basically. Yeah. And I thought that was interesting because like I think it was the doctor or it was one of the guys was basically like, you want to nuke the planet? Are you sure? He's like, don't question my judgment. Just do it. Yeah. It made me think, how much power does a captain really have if he can just be like, crew, fuck this planet up. Like,
fuck this guy.
You just got to fuck this planet up.
I think there's like, it's like, a world where there's like a bunch of planets all over the place.
Yeah. They can
like,
just, they can just afford
expendable.
A couple.
Yeah.
Did you notice that, like, in both of the episodes, the engineers in the transporter room wore these weird robes?
Yeah, the transporter robes.
Yeah, they were green in the No Man Has Gone Before.
It's interesting throughout the history of Star Trek that they obviously there's an influence of the military influence, particularly a naval, sometimes an Air Force influence. But there are repeated attempts here and there to go back to this more militaristic, more modern military idea of different jobs having very different uniforms and daily wear. You know, like in the real military, depending on what you're doing, if you're working on the deck of an aircraft carrier versus below decks versus up in the, you know, conning tower or whatever, you're going to be, there's different things you can wear that are appropriate for different jobs, right? That just only makes sense, right?
The Navy is all about like different costumes.
Yeah, it's like lots of cosplay. Yeah. They try that at the beginning of TOS. They try that at the beginning of TNG.
They did a weird thing in TNG where they had the guys wearing these short mini skirts.
Yeah, the mini skirt thing.
that was kind of
they were making a point.
Yeah, they did. I appreciate it. It was still kind of awkwardly executed, but.
Well, that's like the unfortunately.
It might just be my own hang up.
No. As groundbreaking as Star Trek has always been to one degree or another, it's always groundbreaking up to a point, and then it falters at certain points because the miniskirt thing is cool. TNG did a bunch of brilliant stuff, but then they wouldn't let, you know, when they did the androgynous race episode in TNG.
There was still, you could still tell it was like women.
Well, Jonathan Frakes wanted the actor. They some of them were men, some of them were women.
Right.
But Jonathan Frakes wanted the actor that he would be playing against with the character Soren, I think, whoever he, you know, falls in love with, to be played by a man, and the studios would not allow it.
Right.
And that would have been, that's like the episode was still groundbreaking in a way, but that would have made it like actually extra groundbreaking. But of course, you know, you take what you can get. It's the same, it's like the number one issue in The Cage, you know, it's, they dropped her and that's unfortunate, but
there was an interesting line about, he was reading there was a quote from, I think it was the sonnet, it was called Nightingale Woman, which was apparently written by Tarbold on the Canopius planet way back in 1996.
Yeah, I know, right? But it was actually written by Gene Roddenberry.
Oh.
Apparently he wrote that.
Makes sense. So back then, which is to the future, I wonder what kind of 1996 they had.
I'll tell you my favorite line, and my favorite line is not...
1996 was pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty awesome. There were a number of great lines in both of these episodes. You know, a lot of good writing, you know, a lot of good little soliloquies talking about metaphysical and philosophical concepts of, you know, honor and responsibility and all that. But for some reason, and I'll give credit to, it's all about the line reading. The my favorite line was when Gary Mitchell says, "I'm not joking, Lee."
Oh yeah, I like that too. The delivery is really cool.
I wish I could do it justice because it was just so fucking. Yeah. You know, he's just all talking, then all of a sudden, like, "I'm not joking, Lee."
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Like,
you may want to check those tips. Those, and it's like, "Oh yeah, I'll be sure to." I'm not joking, Lee. See,
see, you better watch out, Lee.
Yeah, that was a good. That was a great delivery.
Well, bust you up.
I'm not joking. It's like, whoa. When they when they were like wrestling him down, they finally, after he zapped him a couple times and they were able to wrestle him down, Kirk instructs Danner. He says, "I want him unconscious for a while," and then she just has on hand magically like the shot to make him unconsciously for a while. See, the issue there is that like they probably would have worked that out beforehand. That whole plan.
Yeah, I guess so.
So why would he say "I want"? Why would they? He tell her how long he wants her unconscious for, which is a sort of ambiguous like. For a while, why would he even say that? Why wouldn't he just be like, "Do it"? Obviously, I guess it's just to inform the audience or whatever. But if he hadn't told her, like, why? If he hadn't, they hadn't worked this out ahead of time because they wanted, you know, it to be a surprise. Why would she just so happen to have unconscious juice on hand real quick? I don't know. I just thought that was kind of it was
unconscious juice.
Also,
maybe that's just, you know, standard practice. You just always carry. If you're a ship's doctor or a nurse, you just better have that.
Out.
You got to probably half the time they're having to knock Kirk out.
According to Daner's file, she is 5'2" and weighs 116 pounds.
She seems tall though.
Yeah,
that doesn't make sense. She seemed taller than that.
She did seem taller. First I think I wrote 5'7", but then I turned it into a 2 because I swear I reread it and it said 2. I'm almost positive it's 5'2". It listed her birth date as 1089.5, but they still listed her age. Why would they list her age if they listed her birth date? They listed her age as 21 years old. She looks a little older than 21.
Yeah, but this is the case of all the people in the 60s, the women and the men, they all looked older than the age.
I can buy that.
Because this is just the way the genes worked in the nuclear age, I think.
And I swear that the intro had a little more pep to it in Where No Man Has Gone
Before. It's a different arrangement. There's a little more bongo,
I think, in it, too. And I really dig the bongo.
Yeah, the once it gets into, so the man trap and, you know, et cetera, that's different, right?
The space looked like kind of some Atari space at the beginning of the episode, which is cool. They had like a red planet looking thing, and it just like looked like an Atari background.
Atari space. Well, how about this? I think we should we've gone a long time here, so I think we should start wrapping it up. Two pretty awesome episodes.
Wait,
any last bits and pieces?
There was a line.
I got nothing.
There was a line that Mitchell gave when he was imprisoned on the planet, and they were talking to him behind the force field before he zapped himself and momentarily came back, and he said something about "Man cannot survive of a race of two espers is born." What the fuck does that mean? That doesn't mean anything.
Isn't that a biblical reference?
I'm sure it is, but like the sentence doesn't make sense to me. Man cannot survive of a race of two espers is born. I don't understand what...
That really doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any sense. The doctor is played by Paul Fix, as in he fixes people, but that's the actor's name.
Fix.
What else? Dr. Jones, it's Smith, sir. Oh, yeah, for some reason he gets the woman on the bridge, he gets her name wrong. He's like, "Dr. Jones?" And she's like, "It's Smith, sir." Like, well, what was that about? Just because like she was supposed to be a nobody? Okay. They never approached that character again.
So here's the deal. Because I wanted to figure this out about your way of saying, man cannot survive if a race of true espers is born. ESPers.
Right.
ESPers.
Okay, and ESPers. It says if. And I swear I turn on closed captioning just to get it right. Maybe the closed captioning spelled if as of. Because I had it as man cannot survive of, which makes no sense. But if you say if, that makes sense. So I think the closed captioning might have fucked it up.
It's a weird line.
Or if I just misread it. But that makes more sense. Man cannot survive if a race of two ESPers is born. That makes a lot of sense. That like makes a lot more sense.
A lot. Makes
sort
a
of,
lot,
I guess.
Makes a lot.
If a race of
sense.
Two espers, but still, it's kind of weird. but I'll go with it.
That dog is jingling and jangling.
The episode, yeah, everything looked a lot brighter, cleaner. I liked it. There was more character. You cared about the characters a little bit more, you know?
Well, it was interesting, because, and I'm glad we watched both these episodes, mm-hmm. because they both feed into what came in the future, you know, after this in Star Trek, because while obviously everything was really based off of, ultimately really based off of Where No Man Has Gone Before, and stemmed from that second pilot, they go back and they reference, not just story-wise, but, you know, sort of thematically and other things. They do touch on stuff from The Cage. There's, the bones are, it still laid the foundations mm-hmm. for the thing. And of course, now you're starting to finally have fun with it. For those who haven't seen Discovery, you should check it out. In season two, they bring in Pike, and that takes place after the events of The Cage. But
I want to rewatch that actually.
And it's interesting, and they do a good job.
Anything in Star Trek about how Kirk replaced Pike?
I forget. I don't remember if there's anything in the canon of Star Trek. I think the implication always was that Pike retired and then Kirk took over. Because later in the Menagerie, when Pike has his accident, I think sometimes people think that Pike had an accident and then Kirk took over, but that's not what happened. Pike had long since, left the Enterprise, possibly even become an admiral at that point. I forget exactly, but he then died in an accident where he was like saving somebody. He didn't die. He got injured in the accident where he was saving somebody in whatever his role was at that time, perhaps at Starfleet Academy or at some other scenario, but he was doing something else.
Pike is no doubt sexy as shit, but like Kirk, you really feel his struggle more with the way the lines are.
It's the difference between Pierce Brosnan and, what's his name these days?
Craig T. Nelson. Yeah. They're constantly emotion shaming Spock.
Yes.
Like, all the time. Like, at the end of the episode, Spock's like, yeah, I feel bad for the guy. And Kirk's like, you piece of shit.
I know, right? No, he really was. Yeah, I forget. And there was, at one point, and then Spock, of course, is all like, it must be one of your Earth emotions.
Yeah, right.
It's like, what does that mean?
Your Earth emotions.
There's good people on both sides, as they say.
Yeah.
No, but they are kind of fucked up to Spock. That is a fair point. Yeah. Anyway, okay, that was cool. So we'll do more of this. Next time, it's going to be Encounter at Farpoint, parts 1 and 2, which is the whole thing.
Oh, we're doing pilots.
Pilots, that's right. We're going pilot to pilot to pilot. We did two pilots this time. So the preview for the future, right? For the future weeks, because we did both pilots this time because they both inform Star Trek moving forward, right? Mm. And it was unusual, first time, as my understanding, the first time in history that a television show got a second pilot. As you guys mentioned, as Jesse mentioned, you know, Lucille Ball was very important.
Yeah, I never knew about that at all.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, but the next one will be Encounter at Farpoint, which of course was there's a lot of interesting history behind that, because it was what's going to happen. A lot of Star Trek fans hated it at first. They hated this next generation because that's how, you know, because it was new. We've seen that now with Discovery and other things. It sort of comes, you know, just happens again. But so we'll check out Encounter at Farpoint, and then we'll do The Emissary for Deep Space Nine. Then we'll do The Caretaker.
That one's friggin' diggy.
Yeah, Emissary is quite good. And then we'll do Voyager's The Caretaker, which is very interesting because just in brief, like, they set up this amazing premise, but they kind of like shut down the clever premise by the end of the pilot episode, which is sort of a bizarre thing.
Couldn't even get that far.
Yeah. And then we'll do Broken Bow for Enterprise.
Broken Boner.
And then it's going to be an interesting thing, because then we'll get
Is Enterprise on Netflix?
Yes. So, and it's an interesting thing for when we get to Discovery, because it could be argued that Discovery kind of has like a three-part pilot in a sense, because the first two episodes, the Vulcan Hello, and what's the other one? The Battle of the Binary Stars. I forget if that's the second one, but it has two episodes.
Can you hook me up with that, Jenks, on some kind of memory stick?
Oh yeah, no, you'll get an opportunity to see that. So
we'll lend you the DVD.
DVD's nuts.
So that there's a two-part episode that sort of sets up the show, but then kind of like the real show starts, because like you know, it's the third episode where it actually like gets to where it's going.
Oh, which
for
one?
Discovery.
Okay.
So we might have to watch like those three episodes for it to make any sense, in a sense, because like if you just watch the first two episodes,
yeah,
they're kind of their self-contained. It's almost like a prequel story.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And then the third episode is where the show basically starts as Discovery. You know, so we'll figure that out. And then
Clem Fandango.
At some point down the line, we're going to do these in a big chunk, but at some point down the line in the future, we'll do Picard, and maybe in the intervening time, we could do something fun, like go check out the animated series.
If you could really call it animated,
that was a
it's
hoot.
Like barely animated.
Yeah, but there's some good stories.
Oh yeah,
there.
They're good.
There's all these like they recycle all these these pictures.
Yeah,
and they recycle like the motion is like, oh, I'm dodging something and shooting like in He-Man.
Yeah,
or I'm doing a barrel roll.
That's great. Yeah. All right. 70s. So it's got Star Trek episode one, the pilots, the cage, and where no man has gone before. Thank you very much. We will see you later. Say goodbye, Dan.
Goodbye, Dan.
Say goodbye, Jesse.
Goodbye.
Excellent. We'll see you all next week with Encounter at Farpoint.
Fuck point.
Fuck.
I was on my coffee break. I thought I'd check up on
you. Yeah. That's okay, Lee. Come on in. Don't let the light in my eyes bother you, pal. It's all for our good-looking lady doctor here.
Yeah, sure.
So how go the repairs?
Well, the main engines are gone. Unless we can find some way to re-energize them.
You better check the starboard impulse packs. Those points have about decayed to lead.
Oh, yeah, sure, Mitch.
I'm not joking, Lee.